This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Asked about the Bill of Rights, chances are you can enumerate the rights guaranteed by a number of them. The right of freedom of speech, the right to avoid self-incrimination. What could you say, though, if asked about the Ninth Amendment? Here is the Ninth Amendment. Rights retained by the people. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. That's the Ninth Amendment. In this portion of the program, we're going to take a closer look at the Ninth. Our guest is Daniel Farber, an alum of the University of Illinois Law School. Daniel Farber is a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. In his book, Retained by the People, Farber calls the Ninth Amendment the Silent Amendment, ignored or disparaged by many jurists and scholars. But Farber says it is deserving of a pivotal role in the resolution of the thorny constitutional debates of our day. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Daniel Farber. You can join us with the telephone call this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. As I mentioned, Daniel Farber earned his J.D. from the University of Illinois. He was editor-in-chief of the U of I Law Review and class valedictorian. He is now Sho Sato Professor of Law at Berkeley and also serves as the director of the school's environmental law program. He's the author of many books, his latest Retained by the People, The Silent Ninth Amendment, and The Constitutional Rights Americans Don't Know They Have, is published by Basic Books. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Farber, greetings from Urbana.
Oh, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. The amendment, the Ninth, it was drafted by James Madison. What need did he see for it? What did he intend?
Well, one of the big arguments about whether to have a Bill of Rights was that some people were afraid if you listed some rights, it would have the effect of wiping out other rights. And the Ninth Amendment was James Madison's answer to that argument. He wanted to make sure that by enumerating rights like freedom of speech or freedom of religion, that in effect there wasn't a side effect of wiping out other rights that might be equally important but simply weren't part of the list at that particular time.
So if we didn't have a Ninth, we might not have had the Bill of Rights in its entirety.
Well, I think probably, I wish I could say that because it would really strengthen my argument, but I don't think that's quite true. I think as part of the deal on establishing the Constitution in the first place, during the ratification debates, the supporters of the Constitution, like Madison, had basically given in and agreed to the idea of a Bill of Rights. But Madison was still worried about this as a possible side effect. And so as part of his kind of explanation of why he had come around to support the Bill of Rights, he wanted to include this to make sure that that it didn't cause these unintentional problems.
Mm. Would it be fair to say that the Ninth Amendment was also a way for the framers to give the Bill of Rights elasticity?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that they knew perfectly well that just because their idea of rights had been shaped by the history leading up to the American Revolution and the post-revolutionary period, but that experience might not be good for all time, and that there could equally well be rights that that hadn't come up yet or hadn't been in controversy yet that ought to be protected.
How did the framers think about rights?
Well, I think today a lot of people think of rights as something that are created by the Constitution. So we have a right to free speech because the First Amendment says so. That really wasn't the way the framers thought. The framers thought of rights as really having a prior existence. The Declaration of Independence talks about it, people being endowed by their creator with inalienable rights, And for us, that's something you maybe hear about before the fireworks start on the 4th of July, but it's not necessarily something that people take completely seriously. It was different then. People really did believe that there were these inherent human rights and that the Constitution wasn't creating rights. It was just providing protection for rights that people already had. And that's why the Ninth Amendment makes sense, because it wasn't a matter of granting people rights in the Bill of Rights, but simply of making sure that rights were honored and respected by the government.
Mm. Did the Declaration of Independence inform, inspire the Bill of Rights?
I think that the kind of thinking that was part of the Declaration was definitely part of the Bill of Rights. And in fact, Jefferson had been somebody who had promoted the Bill of Rights and who had been a drafter of the Declaration. The Declaration also had a big effect well into the 19th century on thinkers like Abraham Lincoln. He really viewed the Declaration as being more important than the Constitution in terms of what America stood for.
Hmm. This history is really fascinating that you've included in the book, Retained by the People. There was a Bill of Rights in Virginia and in Pennsylvania prior to the U.S. Constitution's bill. Did those bills of rights contain something akin to the Ninth?
Well, the earlier bills of rights tended to contain they didn't contain anything exactly parallel to the Ninth, but they did contain language about the purpose of government being to protect the rights of the people and so forth. So they had a different kind of language, but I think the same basic perspective.
And did those bills of rights inspire the framers of the U.S. Constitution?
Yes, when Madison was drafting the Constitution, one of the things he did was look around at what the states had proposed as potential amendments to the Constitution, and at the amendments that already existed, and which often were models. So he was kind of looking around for the best practices or the best ideas that were out there about these provisions. But there were some things, like the specific language of the Ninth Amendment, that were purely his own, that he really added himself.
Hmm. Well, you know, when we talk about rights, we may recall the Declaration's inalienable rights. We may also use the words basic rights, natural rights, fundamental rights, civil rights, human rights. Are these interchangeable?
You know, I think for most purposes they are.
Okay.
A philosopher or a legal theorist, you can draw fine distinctions between them and debate them. But I think, in terms of the way most of us think about rights, they all have the same basic concept of rights that are outside of, or at least beyond the power of government to really grant or to extinguish, that people have everywhere.
Hmm. You call the Ninth Amendment the Silent Amendment. You say it went into hibernation almost as soon as it was created. Why?
That's a question I've really pondered, and it's hard to give a definite answer because, you know, you're talking about a negative here. Why didn't something happen? I think the reason it went into hibernation immediately was simply that the kinds of issues that the Bill of Rights was aimed at just didn't come up in the decades following the adoption of the Bill of Rights. The federal government was engaged in fairly limited activities. There were some big controversies about First Amendment rights, but that was really already covered by the enumerated rights. And so the question of inherent rights just didn't come up. And by the time it came up again, you know, the Ninth Amendment just didn't seem to be part of people's awareness. It wasn't on the radar screen. So I think it was more a historical accident than anything else.
You note that during his confirmation hearing, Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork compared the Ninth Amendment to an ink blot.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us about his objections, his concerns, his worries about the Ninth.
Well, I think that there are really two things driving that answer. One is that he felt that the Ninth Amendment rested on this idea of inherent rights, and he just didn't think that that had any currency anymore, which I think is a mistake. I think, for example, the human rights movement, international human rights movement, shows that it does. And then I think he was also frightened by the what he saw as a kind of open-endedness of the Ninth Amendment, that it might let judges do whatever they, you know, whatever they wanted, rather than being guided by the law. And that was something I think throughout his career that Judge Bork has been concerned about, is this sort of question of judicial activism. And I think that's what scares a lot of people away from the Ninth Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can see it, can't you?
Yeah, I think it's a legitimate concern. I think there are answers, but I wouldn't advocating just setting judges free to implement whatever personal concept of justice and morality they might have.
Yeah. Are there other objections to the Ninth? How else is the amendment viewed by its detractors?
Well, there have been some efforts by some conservative scholars to what I think is basically explain away the Ninth Amendment. So the idea is to come up with some other interpretation, basically says it doesn't mean what it's, you know, what it appears to say. And the main thrust has been to try to argue that it's really about federalism, that it's about states' rights rather than about individual rights. I think that's pretty implausible just on the face of it. For one thing, the Tenth Amendment speaks directly about states' rights, so the Ninth Amendment doesn't really have to. And I think that the history gets pretty contrived. But, you know, you get fairly clever lawyers and give them an argument to make, and they can assemble some information. But I just think that that's a really weak attempt to avoid what I think is the fairly obvious thrust of the language and the history of the Ninth.
Mm. You call the 14th Amendment the heir of the Ninth. That's H-E-I-R.
Right.
How is the Ninth similar to and different from the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment?
Well, there's a basic difference between the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment to start with, and that is that the Bill of Rights, as originally enacted, applied only to the federal government. So, for example, the First Amendment protected the right of free speech, but only against the federal government. The states were still free to do whatever they wanted to in terms of censorship. They were free to establish religions. They were free to engage in cruel and unusual punishments. All of those safeguards applied only to the federal government. So one big difference is that the 14th Amendment extended constitutional rights for protection against the states. Now, the 14th Amendment actually has a number of different clauses, and the Due Process Clause has been the one that the Supreme Court has relied on in cases like the right to privacy. It's actually not a very good choice. The Due Process Clause says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and the problem is that that seems to be fairly obviously aimed at process and procedure, not at the substance of your rights. There's another clause in the 14th Amendment called the Privileges or Immunities Clause that says that no state shall deprive any person of the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. And that's a clause that I think was actually intended by the framers of the 14th Amendment to protect fundamental rights, including the right to freedom of speech, etc. There was another historical accident, given the way the Supreme Court reacted in the aftermath of the Civil War, that kind of rejected that amendment, or at least has buried it for most of the last century or so. But I think that's the amendment that, when you look at the anti-slavery people who eventually went on to write the 14th Amendment, that's the kind of language they would use to protect fundamental rights. I'm afraid I've gotten a little bit into my law professor lecturing mode here, but at least I think that gives you the idea of how the amendments relate.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm not Judge Judy here, so you can speak your mind. Daniel Farber is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Retained by the People, The Silent Ninth Amendment and the Constitutional Rights Americans Don't Know They Have. Professor Farber is a professor of law at Berkeley, at the University of California at Berkeley, where he also serves as the director of the Environmental Law Program. He is the author of several books. This is his latest, Retained by the People, the publisher, Basic Books. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now. A listener in Spring Bay on line four. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I heard on the radio this morning that the federal government was cracking down on California's medical marijuana and hassling the people out there for that. And I wonder if the guest would have any opinion as to the legal claims of the power of the federal government to interfere with what I think would be more of a state's right for California. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, in terms of the state's rights aspect of that, the Supreme Court a couple of years ago decided in favor of the federal government on this issue, that the federal government's general right to regulate drugs was powerful enough to allow it to deal with medical use of marijuana. So I think the what we would call the federalism or states' rights issue here, for better or worse, has been decided. There was a very strong dissent in that case, and so, you know, maybe there's still some room for debate, but at least under current law, I think that one's pretty clear.
Okay, so you wouldn't say the use of medicinal, marijuana is a fundamental right?
That's not something I've actually thought about a great deal, but I think in terms of identifying a fundamental right, I think it probably doesn't qualify. There are a number of factors I would want to look at, with including precedent, which I don't think is there in terms of the federal jurisprudence, at least. Also, at whether state constitutions have recognized this as a fundamental right, or, in fact, whether international courts have recognized the use of drugs for medicinal purposes as a fundamental right. I don't think it's a completely crazy argument, because it's easy to see the appeal of the idea that people have a right to use drugs where necessary for their health.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also such an important level of expert judgment about what drugs are appropriate and which ones are safe and effective and so forth, that I'm not sure that the courts ought to be involved. That's kind of a long-winded answer, but that's partly because it's not something I've thought about, and I don't have a litmus test where I can just dip the paper in the water and immediately tell you, thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yeah. Other telephone calls are invited this afternoon, listeners, if you've got a question or a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. An example you give of something that should not be considered a fundamental right and that does not have constitutional protection is assisted suicide. Why?
The Supreme Court's actually considered that once and decided against it under the Due Process Clause. I quarrel with some of their other decisions, but not this particular one. Again, there are a number of indicators that I would look at. It's not clearly covered by prior precedent. It's had very little recognition in terms of states or internationally. There are a few places that are experimenting with it, like Oregon. The Dutch have also experimented with it. So I think that it doesn't have the kind of general recognition that I would look for. And I think one of the reasons for that is that there are some significant arguments against it in terms of potential for people being pressured or for people making decisions under the influence of depression when it might be treatable, kind of slippery slope arguments that I think it would allow a reasonable person to say that all you know, yes, I'm sympathetic to the reasons why people might want to do this and why they might feel it was very important, but that there is enough uncertainty about it that it might be a little too early to jump in and have the courts declare it as a right. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that Oregon is beginning to allow it is probably just what the federal system should be doing, which is allowing individual states to take that first step in exploring new territory, and then the country as a whole will have the opportunity to decide what we think and whether this is something that should be more general.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Hello, yes. I'm wondering if you could comment on the notion that perhaps the rights that are proclaimed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights should likewise be recognized as constitutional through the vehicle of the Ninth Amendment. And I'm thinking in particular of a right like education, which the Supreme Court has never quite managed to declare as a fundamental right, even though it got close in cases like Brown. But it's a little nervous to say that they're constitutional, but it wants to call them fundamental, and whether perhaps there's some interplay between the rights that are recognized explicitly in the Universal Declaration and implicitly in the Ninth Amendment. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there is interplay. I don't think the Ninth Amendment automatically adopts something like the UN Convention, but I think that since these are human rights, international conventions or the rulings of courts like the European Court of Justice are very relevant. That's something that's very controversial, especially with conservatives, but that's another area where I actually think the original understanding is quite clear about looking internationally. I also think specifically about education, that should be recognized as a right under the Ninth Amendment. And again, based on the kinds of factors I've looked at, many of the state constitutions recognize it. State courts have enforced it. International conventions recognize it. It's something that, just from a common sense basis, I think most people would endorse. So I do agree about education, and I think that the Supreme Court's nervousness about recognizing this right is misplaced.
And forgive me if I wasn't listening closely enough, but why hasn't the Supreme Court taken this up and seen an adequate basic education a basic right?
The issue came up to the Supreme Court in the 1970s, and the court shied away from intervening in educational funding in particular. There were, and continue to be, big problems in states where some school districts get lots more money per student mm-hmm. than other districts. I think it was part of the court's general reaction against what they saw as the activism of the Warren Court, and in particular, a reluctance to get the lower federal courts involved in kind of reforming school finance. And then since then, the court just really hasn't returned to the issue except kind of in passing. I think maybe the court just doesn't see it as a priority or is afraid that if they recognize education, they might then be asked to think about other rights like medical care or housing, and they don't want to get started on that. But I think that's one where they're clearly wrong. Mm. There are a lot of these issues that I think are really difficult, and I, you know, sometimes although I may disagree with the court, I think they're on, you know, taking a reasonable position. But on this one, I don't think so. I think that the court simply has failed to confront the evidence. It may be that if they looked at it again, the evidence of what the state courts have been doing would be persuasive too. This was 30 years ago, and I think there's a stronger foundation today for viewing it as a fundamental constitutional right.
Mm. Speaking of education and assisted suicide and how other countries see these matters, has the Ninth come into play in the debate over whether and how to look abroad in our consideration, our definitions of, our protections of human rights?
It really hasn't, at least up until now. And one of the things that I really try to stress in the book is the importance of doing that. And it's not just in order to expand the idea of rights. I just think that, in fact, in some areas, looking abroad might help us see that some things really shouldn't be considered fundamental rights because we see that there isn't any kind of international support. But we're talking about rights that are supposed to be inalienable, that everybody is supposed to have, and I think it's just foolish to think that only Americans have insights into these issues. There was this kind of firestorm of protest in a couple of cases when the Supreme Court referred to international legal opinions, and if you go back and look at the framers, you would think that was crazy because they were constantly referring to laws in England, laws on the continent, to well-known legal authorities from Europe who wrote treatises about international law, to decisions of other courts. They were totally the opposite from today's conservatives in terms of being cosmopolitan and looking abroad for insights.
What is it that makes conservatives nervous about looking outside the borders of the United States?
Well, I think part of it may just be part of a general fear of entanglement in foreign affairs, the same reasons why the Bush administration didn't want to be bound by the Geneva Conventions or withdrew from the Kyoto Protocols that don't really relate specifically to this dispute about rights. But I think part of it is also a fear that there are a bunch of liberal, you know, or leftist Europeans, and that this will just be a way of sneaking these sort of suspect left-wing notions into American law. And I don't actually think that part's true. But I think part of it, if there were a lot of conservative international tribunals out there that people were talking about, then you know, maybe conservatives would be a little more happy about the idea.
Mm. If we can go back to those Senate confirmation hearings for Judge Bork, how was it that the Ninth Amendment came up? And is the Ninth Amendment a typical topic of questioning and confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominees?
I don't think that's the only time it's come up, but that's certainly the most notable time. And the reason it came up was in discussion of a case called Griswold, which involved a Connecticut law that banned the sale of contraceptives. And the Supreme Court in 1963, I think, had declared that unconstitutional. One of the justices, Justice Goldberg, wrote extensively about the Ninth Amendment in his concurring opinion. And Bork had not only rejected Griswold, but really kind of mocked it as an opinion. And that was something that the Senate panel was very concerned about. And in discussing this issue with him, the Ninth Amendment was kind of an obvious thing to ask about. And for somebody who purports to believe in the original intent and in following the text of the Constitution, that was a difficult question for Bork because the Ninth Amendment just doesn't take his view of the world. So somehow or another, he had to get around it. And the same thing has been true of Justice Scalia when he's discussed the Ninth Amendment today, which is, it's really kind of embarrassing for him that it's in the Constitution, and he's got to do something to, you know, hide it or run away from it, or at least avoid confronting what it says.
Hmm. How do other current members of the court view the Ninth?
I think it hasn't been discussed much. I'm hoping that it will be in the future. Justice Scalia has really rejected it as being essentially rhetorical or political rather than a legal statement. I think, ironically, the most conservative member of the court, Justice Thomas, might actually be open to thinking about the Ninth Amendment because he's got a kind of libertarian streak that might make him sympathetic. I think it's something that the justices on the more liberal wing of the court really could get some mileage out of. In the big attack from people like Scalia has been that the Supreme Court just made up this idea of fundamental rights, that it's not in the Constitution, and that it doesn't have any legal support. And I think the Ninth Amendment could really be useful in defending some of what the court has done to protect fundamental rights, but they haven't been able to really persuasively connect it with the language and the history of the Constitution.
Hmm. Is it often, is it frequently, is it ever, you mentioned Griswold, but is it, how often has it been mentioned in decisions? Has it ever been the basis for a decision?
It's never been the basis for a decision. It's very sporadically mentioned. It's really, I think, partly attributable to the habits of lawyers, which is that we like precedent, we like the tried and true, and we don't like the novel or unexpected. When a judge says that another judge's argument is creative, that's not a compliment. and I think that can be good. Stability is a good thing. We don't, you know, we don't want the law blowing around with every wind of you know, whatever fashionable thought is. But you can also just end up reinforcing something, either because somebody said it once, then it gets said over and over again, or because it hasn't been said or a court hasn't relied on it before, then that by itself becomes a reason for not doing it. So it's very much a kind of self-reinforcing cycle, and often healthy, but sometimes you can kind of miss the obvious just because it's like the emperor's has no clothes, right? You know, nobody is naive enough to point out that the fact that the Ninth Amendment has a clear message. Because if you're a sophisticated lawyer, you know that the courts don't rely on the Ninth Amendment.
Hmm.
And there's no reason why they don't rely on it. They just don't. And so, you know, we go with what's established and what has worked in the past.
Has the book been out long enough now to get some reaction, to get some reviews from people on the left, on the right, liberals, conservatives, scholars, jurists, to your arguments, to your looking at the history?
There's been some debate in the blogosphere, especially on a couple of conservative blogs where there's been really intensive discussion of the idea. A little early for published reviews. I've gotten some very good word of mouth from legal scholars and a couple of judges about the book, so I'm kind of optimistic. But I think it takes a while to reframe the debate and get people to start talking about issues through this different lens.
Hmm. Daniel Farber, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Retained by the People, The Silent Ninth Amendment and the Constitutional Rights Americans Don't Know They Have. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. You can join us today with a question, a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign County on line one. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. As a first thing, the earlier caller about the right to education in the, enshrined in the international human rights reminds me that it's an interesting subject, and I haven't visited it in a while, but there are tens, and I think it's some tens over 100 international instruments that the United States is not a signatory to. ILO treaties, all sorts of things, that it shares dubious distinctions of being in with Iran and Saudi Arabia and things like that. So that's just something for people to Google if they want to look for that. These are a lot of rights that other people have internationally have been established that apparently don't pertain to the remain to the people here. But I wanted to get to the right of privacy, and I don't know that that's been discussed quite yet.
But it hasn't.
You have mentioned it, huh? Well, from the point of view that in the early 1700s, late 1700s, when things were being formulated, if I'm remembering well now, 1786 or some years. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights came in, and at that time. There weren't a lot of invasive mechanisms that we have now, and privacy was sort of already sort of presumptively pertained, one could argue. At that time, you know, the Catholic Church regarded life starting at the quickening, and things were private before that in a lot of ways. I don't know whether you approached it, Harry. It's certainly one that would be worth reprising, if you would.
No, we have not.
Oh, I'm
talked
sorry.
About it. I'm okay. sorry you didn't.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Misheard, then,
I
yeah.
mumbled.
Go,
so,
ahead, then.
So let's talk about privacy, Daniel Farber.
Well, I think that the idea of the right to privacy is well founded. I think privacy is kind of a general concept. So what I try to do is look at specific issues within that rubric of privacy, like the right to use contraceptives, the right to engage in intimate relationships, the right to abortion, and try to look at the right to refuse medical treatment at the end of life, and try to look at those individually rather than wrapping them up in the right to privacy. But I think those are the kinds of rights that really go to the heart of our identity as people and to our ability to control our lives. Those are the kinds of rights that I think the Ninth Amendment is addressed to. On the other point, I think it's really a shame. The United States has been a leader in the field of rights for so much of our history, and one of the things I would like to see us do, partly through the Ninth Amendment, is to regain that position so that other countries will look to us as the sort of shining beacon of what protection of human rights ought to look like, instead of having us on the sidelines and ignoring the rest of the world.
Well, it's not so much on the sidelines. We're advocating policies that we used to condemn in other countries, such as, you know, pervasive wiretapping without judicial oversight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we talk with someone on a cell phone on line 4, south of us on I-70. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to follow up with the last comment from a caller. The glaring question of our time, the right of same-sex couples to marry in the United States. Certainly other countries have surpassed us, like Spain and England. And I wonder how, if your guest there addresses that in his book, and that right of certain group of people that would like to pursue happiness in this country.
Okay.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, I do discuss that right, that argument at least, and I think that's one where at least some of my friends will be disappointed, because my conclusion is that at least at this point, I don't think that legally gay marriage is a fundamental right. I don't think it's quite time to recognize it, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One of them is the fact that it's so, again, like assisted suicide. It's something that a few jurisdictions here and elsewhere have experimented with, but it doesn't have a kind of broad acceptance. And even courts that have recognized, like the Massachusetts court, that recognized gay marriage, didn't say that it was a fundamental right. In fact, they reject that. They had a different theory about gay marriage. There are some other arguments about Constitution and gay marriage, about discrimination law as opposed to fundamental rights law, and I don't address those in the book. But I came to the conclusion that this is another area where I think it's at least too early for the Supreme Court to come in and declare a victor, that this is something that needs to be worked out in the states and in the democratic process, at least for the present, until our society comes to a clear-cut view. So this is, I think, an example where I don't think the Ninth Amendment really incorporates anybody's dream list of what society ought to be like. It's something that incorporates some rights, but maybe doesn't incorporate everything that everyone would like to see in the Constitution. It's not just the liberal bill panacea for all of the issues that we would like to see society address.
Let's take another call. A listener in West Chicago, line 2. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. You know, this is quite a good discussion on the Constitution. You know, there are so many people out there that are trying to bend it or break it or trying to modify it to fit their needs, or groups, I should say. And, you know, I've heard so many or I shouldn't say heard, I've read so many articles on modernizing the Constitution. To me, that's would be the downfall of this country, and I think that's the way it's going. Like the gentleman that called before me, you know, talking about gay marriage, well, you know, I don't care what anybody does with their own time or their own personal views, as long as it doesn't offend me, or not, I shouldn't say offend me or affect me. It doesn't offend me if somebody gay wants to get married. The problem is when I've said this all along, and a lot of people are saying this, what right does the government have to tell anybody anything to do with their life? And it's gotten so out of control in this country, it's ridiculous. We've got homeowners associations that tell you what you can and you can't do. You got organizations out there that now, you know, we all know that smoking is an unhealthy act. I don't smoke, never have, and never will. But I don't think it's the government's right to tell us what we can and we can't do. It ought to be up to the individual businesses. You know, I could go on and on with a list a mile long. People are fed up with the government telling us what to do.
Okay,
and
well,
to me, it's just ridiculous that the Constitution, in my point of view, should be ought to be left alone. And it, we had, you know, it's same thing goes with religion. You know,
I'm going to hop in, and I think we got your drift, and let's go to Daniel Farber.
Well, I think that there's something very appealing about the idea of the right to be left alone or the right to do anything you want as long as it doesn't harm other people. I think, though, that that's a lot broader than what the Ninth Amendment at least guarantees. There's a lot of room for disagreement about what's legitimate government action in general and what isn't. About a century ago, the Supreme Court said that minimum wage and maximum hour laws were unconstitutional because people had the right to make whatever kind of contract they wanted. If they wanted to work an 80-hour week, that was their right. If they wanted to work for 10 cents an hour, that was also their constitutional right. The Supreme Court ultimately saw that that was a mistake, that the question in general of what is a legitimate area for government regulation is really one that has to be decided through the political process rather than the courts. So I view the Ninth Amendment and this idea of fundamental rights as being not protecting everything that we might want to do from being regulated by the government, leaving that to the political process, except in the areas where the government's interference is so basic to our ability to call our lives our own. That we ought to consider it to be a constitutional right. If I try to resist having kind of a catchphrase for what the Ninth Amendment protects, but in a sense, I guess if I had to sum it up, I'd say it's sort of the right to have ownership of our own lives. And there are a lot of government regulations that might be a bad idea and might be very annoying seem very irritating interferences with our freedom, but they don't really interfere with that fundamental ability to call our lives our own. And it's those interferences that I think the Ninth Amendment needs and should address.
Hmm. As this has been the Silent Amendment, what drew your attention to it? What led you to write this book, Retained by the People?
What really led me to it was the history more than anything else. As a constitutional law professor, I've been interested in this question of fundamental rights for a long time. But what made me think I had something to say was that as I started reading beyond just the congressional records, but trying to understand the thinking of people when the Constitution was framed and to understand their perspective on the world, the more I read, the more it seemed clear to me that the Ninth Amendment wasn't just a kind of afterthought in the sense that it really expressed something basic about their perspective on the world. And then once I started looking at the Ninth Amendment and thinking about it, this may be sort of self-delusion, but it seemed more and more obvious to me that the Ninth Amendment did speak directly to this question of fundamental rights and that we had really, as scholars and lawyers, we'd really overlooked something important.
There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Daniel Farber, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. Daniel Farber is professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. He earned his J.D. from the University of Illinois. He's the author most recently of Retained by the People, The Silent Ninth Amendment, and The Constitutional Rights Americans Don't Know They Have, the publisher, Basic Books.